You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nubs. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on report from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on the rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry Hahn, woman liberationist, and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Coming up, the West Coast Action Plan on Climate and Energy. The U.S. states of California, Oregon, Washington, and the Canadian province of British Columbia have signed a pact to reduce carbon dioxide emissions by putting a price on carbon. British Columbia's Environmental Minister, Mary Poulat, discusses the agreement and how a carbon tax is working in the province with Steve Curwood. And then later on, the price of climate protection. Physicist Joseph Rahm of the blog Climate Progress and Steve Curwood discuss the IPCC's cost-benefit analysis of immediate and delayed climate action.
I'm Steve Curwood. President Obama says he wants to do more about climate protection, but Congress is not on board. So states continue to act on their own. And now two major regional climate compacts have been signed, and one even includes a Canadian province. Eight states have banded together to create a common infrastructure for electric cars, and we'll have more on that later. But first, we turn to a deal struck by California, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia to coordinate climate policies and put a price on carbon emissions. The governors of Washington and Oregon have pledged to get laws passed in their states to make burning carbon more expensive. And California already has a cap-and-trade program. British Columbia has a carbon tax. That tax is working well, according to Environment Minister Mary Poulat, and she says it'll work even better as part of this new Pacific Coast Action Plan on Climate and Energy.
For us in British Columbia, we're certainly in a leadership role around the world with respect to actions on climate change. But we are a very small population. We're 4.5 million people thereabouts. So very quickly, you can see that when we stack ourselves up against the world, we don't have a tremendous impact. By creating this jurisdictional grouping on the west coast of North America, we certainly have a greater potential for influence on world climate change policies, but also we have the opportunity to work together to build things such as a robust clean energy sector, clean tech sector, and those are the kinds of things that work very well when we join our jurisdictions geographically, and we believe that from that we have the potential to grow and influence even more jurisdictions around North America and indeed around the world.
So a big part of this Pacific Coast Action Plan is to reduce carbon dioxide emissions by putting a price on carbon throughout the region, making it more expensive to pollute. How's that going to work for each of these states and, of course, BC, where you already have a flat tax on carbon pollution?
Yeah, we've had a carbon tax, and it's revenue neutral. We've had that in place since 2008. Other regions will do so according to how it fits for their local area. That's fine with us. Our concern has always been that if we remained the only jurisdiction nearby that had a price on carbon, then that potentially had a negative impact on our business competitiveness. Obviously, we think our model is the best, but we're pleased with any action that's taken by other governments, no matter what form, to put a price on carbon and therefore level the playing field.
Briefly, what has been your experience with the tax? How expensive is it?
Well, so our tax currently amounts to $30 per ton. It didn't start at 30, it started at 10. We gradually increased it over time. Ours is revenue neutral, though, so it means that for every penny in carbon tax that we take in as government, the Minister of Finance is required to put that back out in the equivalent amount of tax reductions. So various ones such as income tax, corporate taxes, small business taxes, and specific taxes geared toward northern and remote residents who have to pay more and have little fewer chances to reduce their emissions and reduce their consumption in terms of heating and things like that. So revenue neutral, our experience has been that since 2008, our province has bucked the trend in Canada. In fact, our GDP has grown at a faster rate than the Canadian average. At the same time, our consumption of fossil fuels has reduced significantly across every fuel type. So it's easy to do that when your economy's not growing, but to have your economy grow and at the same time reduce your reliance on fossil fuels is not an easy task.
Can you give me a number on how much reduction?
About 15%.
What's the plan to encourage more use of alternative energy in BC?
That's an important question, because when you deal with what is essentially a cultural shift, it's not just going to be one measure, such as a price on carbon, that's going to achieve that. So we have a whole range of initiatives, all the way from incentives for clean energy vehicles to incentives for industries to reduce emissions and for individuals to reduce emissions. We also, of course, through our purchase of carbon offsets, also contribute to innovative clean energy businesses within British Columbia. Our carbon offset purchases are all required to be within British Columbia. So all of this cycles through and then contributes back into improving our emissions profile in our local jurisdiction.
Now, right next door to British Columbia is Alberta, home of the Athabasca tar sands. How are you folks getting along?
Well, our premier has been making tremendous inroads with respect to helping Alberta understand our perspective. There certainly is a different culture in Alberta versus British Columbia around petroleum and how we operate with that. But I have to say, fundamentally, there isn't a large disagreement. Both jurisdictions believe very strongly that we can achieve leadership on climate change while at the same time balancing our need for economic growth to be able to benefit our citizens, earn the revenues that it takes to afford things like health care, education, and other important social benefits. So I don't think we really start out that far apart. Of course, the highlight right now is the discussions we're having around the pipeline potential from Alberta to the West Coast in order to reach those Asian markets. But those are legitimate discussions to have, and I don't think they should be viewed as British Columbia and Alberta in an argument more than they should be viewed as British Columbia and Alberta trying to find the solution to the balance you have to strike.
How are you hoping that the Pacific Coast Action Plan might affect the rest of the United States and Canada?
Well, So for politicians to take action on climate change is a risky proposition. They are complex topics to communicate, and often they are difficult in terms of public policy because you're asking people to take a sacrifice now for a benefit that won't accrue to them for very many years. It's not an easy thing for a politician to sell. And as we've experienced in British Columbia, having now won two majority elections with our climate policy front and center, our carbon tax front and center, it makes it a lot more palatable for politicians to lead on climate change when they see an example that has actually worked, where we can say, look, we've had the positive benefit we wanted, it hasn't damaged our economy, and by the way, we actually got reelected on this basis. So every time we can show that an experience has been successful, that gives greater capacity for politicians to move on these issues and to lead on these matters.
Now, California and the province of Quebec recently announced a collaboration on their cap and trade programs. They both have them. How might Quebec be brought into the Pacific Coast Action Plan?
Well, there is, of course, the Western Climate Initiative. That's something that British Columbia is also a part of. These things are evolving over time, and as policy positions on climate change grow and evolve and mature, we're going to see movement in different areas. I think not only is there potential to bring Quebec into the fold on agreements like this, but we also know from Governor Jerry Brown that California has been making significant inroads into bringing China, provinces in China, into accords such as this. So there's tremendous potential.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time with me today. Mary Polack is the Environment Minister for the province of British Columbia.
Thank you very much.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
I'd like to say a few words. Defense of our country, whose people aren't bad, nor are they mean. Now the leaders we have, while they're the worst that we've had, are hardly the worst this poor world has seen. Let's turn history's pages, shall we? Take the Caesars, for example. While at the first few of them, they were sleeping with their sister, stashing little boys in swimming pools and burning down the city. And one of them appointed his own horse to be consul of the empire. That's like vice president or something. That's not a very good example right now, is it? But here's one. Spanish Inquisition. That's a good one. Put people in a terrible position. I don't even like to think about it. Sometimes I like to think about it. Just a few words. Defense of our country. It's time at the top. Could be coming to an end. But we don't want their love. Respect at this point's pretty much out of the question. But time like these, we sure could use a friend. Hitler, Stalin, men who need no introduction. King Leopold of Belgium, that's right. Everyone thinks he's so great. Well, he owned the Congo. He tore it up, too. Took the diamonds, took the silver, took the gold. You know what he left him with? Malaria. You know, a president once said, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Now it seems like we're supposed to be afraid. It's patriotic, in fact, color-coded. What we're supposed to be afraid of? Why being afraid? That's what terror means, doesn't it? That's what it used to mean. What pisses me off a little that this Supreme Court's gonna outlive me. A couple young Italian fellas and a brother on the court now, too. But I defy you, anywhere in the world, to find me two Italians as tight ass as the two Italians we got. And as for the brother, well, Bangladesh not a planet anymore either. The end of an empire is messy at best. And this empire's ending, like all the rest, like the Spanish Armada, drift on the sea. We're adrift in the land of the brave, in the home of the free. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.
I'm Steve Curwood. Urgent action now, or a king's ransom later. That's the word from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. As part of the latest assessment, IPCC scientists did the math of the costs and benefits of cutting greenhouse gas emissions quickly and deeply. They found that stalling on action now will only raise the price to deal with the inevitable rising seas, drought, and climate-forced migrations. We asked former Assistant Energy Secretary Joe Rome to weigh in on the report's recommendations. He's an author, physicist, and climate expert who heads the blog Climate Progress. Welcome to Living on Earth, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
How much has the public perception changed about climate since you were Assistant Secretary for Energy?
Oh, well, that was back in the mid-1990s. And I think the general awareness is considerably higher, both about the impacts of climate change and the solutions. And I think in particular, the kind of off-the-charts extreme weather of the last 3 years has clearly influenced a lot of people and made them realize that climate change is right here, right now.
Joe, how fair is it to say that the IPCC report claims that we're headed for economic disaster if we don't act quickly and strongly? Some folks say that it just costs too much in the economy to do the kind of things that are being recommended.
Well, I think that the new IPCC report lays to rest the notion that it is expensive to act. And in fact, it actually says that stabilizing the climate would cost about 0.06% of economic growth per year, 0.06%. It would be the difference between having global economic growth of 2% versus 2.06%. So, you know, really a drop in the bucket. Many of the people who have spoken about this have made clear that, you know, we're kind of running out of time. We have a closing window to aggressively cut emissions and stabilize carbon pollution at levels that are viewed as not catastrophic. But that window is closing, and every year that you wait adds more to the cost. And indeed, it's, you know, the International Energy Agency has previously calculated that, you know, every dollar you spend now saves $4 after the year 2020. The cost of inaction is enormous. You know, steadily rising seas, ever worsening droughts, problems with food, problems with conflict, heat waves, superstorms. And the co-chair of the committee that wrote this report said, quote, "We cannot afford to lose another decade. If we lose another decade, it becomes extremely costly to achieve climate stabilization."
The IPCC's chairperson, Dr. Pachauri, has said that, and I quote here, "the high-speed mitigation train needs to leave the station very soon, and all of global society needs to get on board." What do you make of that statement?
Well, we have to start being much more aggressive in the carbon-free sources. I mean, the good news is that a couple decades of major investment have really brought the cost of solar power down a stunning amount. I mean, we're talking about a 99% drop in the cost of solar power in the last quarter century, and a very rapid drop in the cost of wind power, and other drops in the course of batteries and energy-efficient equipment. So the technology is there, but we have to ramp it up at a much faster rate if we are going to avoid, you know, destroying a livable climate.
What about the notion of that it's really cheap to use carbon-polluting fossil fuels and other things, cutting trees that add to global warming, and that some folks say that we need to put a price on carbon so people make other choices?
Well, absolutely. Right now, there's no cost for carbon pollution, so people can just treat the atmosphere as an open sewer, whereas we know that carbon pollution has a significant economic cost to us and a cost in human health. So one obvious thing to do, which economists have always advised, is to make the cost of pollution equivalent to its harm to humans and society. And this IPCC report, when it's looking at what is the most cost-effective way for the world to deal with climate change, a price on carbon is one of the top policies.
Now, what does the IPCC say about fossil fuels and our energy economy in general?
It says that if you want to stabilize carbon pollution at livable levels, then you have to start very aggressively expanding some combination of renewable energy, energy efficiency, nuclear power, and carbon capture and storage. And that's where you capture the carbon pollution coming out of a fossil fuel plant. And that has to rapidly expand. We're using more fossil fuels today than we can be using in 2050. So even in the case of natural gas, which some people see as a bridge fuel, it's only a bridge fuel if it is considerably less leaky than we know it is today, because natural gas is mostly methane, and when it leaks out of the ground, it is a potent greenhouse gas. And secondly, we need to peak in natural gas consumption, you know, over the next decade or two, and then get down to levels below current levels by 2050. So the world really has to make a concerted global effort to get off carbon pollution and fossil fuels.
What's the time scale here, Joe? How quickly do we have to make these changes if we want to avoid these, well, at least the most catastrophic consequences of climate disruption?
The IPCC warns that there are various tipping points that will, once they're crossed, become very hard, if not impossible, to come back to. At some point, you have triggered a rate of sea level rise that really can't be reversed. The same for changes in temperature rises. And one of the biggest concerns raised in the first report was that you would trigger a defrosting of the permafrost in the Arctic region, Siberia and Canada and Alaska. And if it starts to defrost, then it emits carbon, both in the form of carbon dioxide and methane, which is even more potent greenhouse gas. So there is a great concern that we are approaching these thresholds and tipping points. And, you know, these are not the kind of risk you would ever take in your personal life if you could avoid them at a low cost. And, you know, we know that we can avoid them at a low cost. But it does mean this is the decade we have to act.
What do you make of the IPCC's recommendation in this report that involves the burning of biomass in conjunction with carbon capture and sequestration? First, tell me what that process is, and then tell me how effective you think it might be.
There are some, but not a lot, of demonstrations around the world of burning fossil fuels, particularly coal, where instead of releasing the carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, you capture it and stick it underground in some sort of permanent repository, like a well or a deep underground aquifer. Now, if you could take biomass, which is just plant matter that grew by absorbing CO2 and burned that and captured its carbon, then plants would take the carbon out of the air, and the carbon capture would then put the carbon underground. You know, we are certainly going to have an all-hands-on-deck approach because of all of our, you know, quarter century of dawdling. So I do think we are certainly going to have to try carbon capture and storage with biomass. But it's clear that no one would do that if there wasn't a price on carbon.
So what do you make of the IPCC essentially recommending a form of geoengineering here if you burn biomass and then do carbon capture and sequestration? It's a form of geoengineering.
We're doing geoengineering now by pumping massive amounts of carbon pollution into the atmosphere and heating the planet up, melting ice, and changing the Earth's climate patterns. There's nothing wrong with trying to pull CO2 out of the air. I think it should be obvious to almost anybody that not putting the carbon dioxide into the air is always going to be a lot cheaper compared to sort of burning the coal when it's just sitting there in the ground as solid carbon in the first place.
Now, many people around the world, of course, are already feeling the impacts of climate change on every continent. What does the report say about the need for adaptation?
There's no question that we are stuck with serious climate change, and yes, everyone is going to have to adapt. There is no escape from that. The issue is that if you don't take effort to mitigate, to reduce carbon pollution. Most climate experts would tell you that adaptation can't be accomplished in a meaningful sense of the word. You know, the classic way humans have adapted in the past is to abandon uninhabitable areas. You know, the word desert comes from the same derivation as a deserted place. It is an abandoned place. It's a place you can't live anymore. Now, we are, according to lay science, turning more and more parts of the world into dust bowls and deserts. So, you know, people can quote-unquote adapt by simply leaving. Now, clearly, if you are talking about places where hundreds of millions of people live, where are they going to go without creating some sort of strife? This question of how are we going to feed 9 billion people after the year 2050 is a great, great concern of the IPCC. And that may require a very different farming system. We're going to have to redesign our agricultural and food delivery system to minimize waste, to maximize the use of whatever arable land and fresh water we have. We are talking about deep and abiding change in the lives of billions of people. A change that, by the way, we are forcing on them because of our greed and myopia, because we simply won't spend this small fraction of our wealth to prevent decades, if not centuries, of a worsening climate that people will have to suffer through.
Joe Rome is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he edits the blog Climate Progress. Joe, thanks so much for taking the time with us today and sharing your insights.
Thanks for having me.
Unreasonable Women, a Modest Proposal, dedicated to the indigenous women of Nigeria who took on Chevron and won. Dedicated also to Bearing Witness.
If the news gets too depressing and you feel you can't go on, take off your clothes, take off your clothes, and circle the Pentagon. If the government annoys you and you don't know what to do, take off your clothes, take off your clothes, and circle the White House too.